Dave, thanks for coming on the show. So many people are talking about liquid cooling. When you talk about liquid cooling, what, as it relates to data centers, what on earth does that mean?
It means a lot, David. There are a lot of different things. So I think I can break it down to some digestible chunks. When we're talking about liquid cooling, we're talking about taking the cooling medium directly to the IT equipment,
okay,
right? We're not bridging the gap with air. We're using a liquid of some type mm-hmm. to transfer that heat from where we don't want it in the rack
right.
to where we rather take it to, which is outside.
Right.
So I would break those down into two main groups, direct liquid to chip.
Okay.
The other group would be immersion.
Okay.
And then within those two groups, I'd say single phase and two phase. And I'll touch on that a little bit.
Okay.
But let's start out with direct liquid to chip first.
Okay.
What we're doing in this situation is we're putting cold plates on key components within the server. It could be CPUs, GPUs, voltage regulators, memory DIMM, those things that produce heat.
Mm-hmm.
And we're running a fluid to them into the rack, which terrifies some people.
Yeah.
And we're taking that heat directly off those components and
yeah.
pulling it out. That in a gist is direct liquid to chip. We could do it with a single phase fluid, which is just one that it goes in water, comes out water,
mm-hmm.
or a dual phase, which goes in water and comes out partially gas, partially some other liquid, whatever it is, a refrigerant.
Right.
So that's direct liquid to chip.
Okay.
It's sort of distilled down to its basics.
Okay. You're right. It's counterintuitive. I generally, as much as we talk about cloud, there really is no water vapor involved. And so when I talk to people not involved in digital infrastructure about this idea of we're going to introduce some sort of liquid into cooling computer electronic equipment, you know, inevitably the eyebrow goes up. Like, what are we talking about? So before we go any further, I guess, how do we do cooling before liquid cooling? And then the second part would be, why are we talking about liquid cooling now?
Great questions. So before, and how we do it today,
right.
for the most part, is we use what we call precision air conditioners or precision air handlers
mm-hmm.
to remove that heat. We put air into the space at a temperature that's cold enough to transfer the heat away from the ITE. We gather that heat up, and then we take it to the outside and disperse it. It's a very robust, mature technology
mm-hmm.
as far as removing the heat. We've gotten better over the years of doing it more efficiently and doing it on a larger scale,
mm-hmm.
but it's the air that we use. And being mm-hmm. an HVAC guy for mm-hmm. a long time,
mm-hmm.
I like the fact that we use air.
Yeah.
But I also understand that the physics and the economics of liquid cooling have to displace some of that air cooling as we move forward.
Well, I've done a lot of maintenance windows in a data center. We have, with air, we have this concept, I know you're familiar with it, of hot aisle and cold aisle.
Mm-hmm.
So the hot aisle is where the heat comes, usually the back of a data center rack, and the cold aisle is the front where the cold air is introduced and mm-hmm. is drawn through the racks. And at my age and weight out there, I much prefer working in the cold aisle. Because if I work in the hot aisle, I'm making sweat angels on the back of those racks.
Me too.
Let me tell you, that's not a good image for anybody.
Yeah.
And it's not good for the systems. And so I suppose, you know, so air forever has done the job. When we talk about liquid cooling, as you explained it to us, and we see this impact, before we spend more time on the why, is liquid direct to the chip that you talked about, is that the only form of liquid that's under consideration? Are there other forms that people are evaluating to see if they'll work?
Absolutely, David. So the other major form factor is immersion cooling.
Okay.
And if you're familiar with that technology at all, basically what you've done is you've stripped down the servers and you've immersed them in a bath of something other than water.
Okay. Yeah. Let's hope.
and what happens is all the heat that's generated on that piece of equipment is then absorbed into that liquid bath, which is then taken to the outside, and that heat is rejected.
Okay.
Currently, there are folks that put that technology out as a single phase,
mm-hmm.
And there's also folks that put it out as a two-phase. And, of course, the advantage there for the two-phase is that as the energy goes from the servers into the liquid bath and you actually flash some of the coolant to gas, mm-hmm. it absorbs a tremendous amount of heat. So
what do you mean flash it to gas? What
is that? So let's think about water for a second. Water sitting on in a pan on our stove.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we put it on there, it's in a liquid form. It's 100% liquid. Now we put heat to it, and what happens is the temperature of that water will go up to 212 degrees at one atmosphere, and as long as there's water there, it won't go any higher, no matter how much I turn that gas off.
Right.
Because that energy, that heat, is now being used to turn that water. Liquid water into a vapor.
Right.
Steam. Right. Steam.
Right.
Right. Exactly. So that's what happens with a volatile refrigerant as well. It's the same process. It's the latent heat of vaporization, and that's why we make air conditioners the way we do.
Right.
So that's the other form of liquid cooling that's out there. And these two are competing globally right now. And it's my take that in some areas, immersion seems to be leading the charge. And in other areas, I think in North America, direct liquid to chip seems to be leading the charge.
Why do you think it's leading the charge?
I think it's because it's a little easier to retrofit older facilities in many respects. I think there's still a lot of hesitation of stripping down servers and immersing them in a fluid. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the keys is that major server manufacturers are producing off-the-shelf OEM-manufactured servers with hoses hanging out the back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you have your warranties intact and everything else. And I think that just gives people a warm fuzzy that this is a good way to do it.
We build buildings to be, if at all possible, at least 100, if not 200-year buildings. I mean, that's genuinely true.
Yeah.
And so that's the shell. We recognize that the floor infrastructure could change, the connectivity that we use may change. It changed from copper to fiber. There may be other emerging technologies. So we realize that things change, but the shell is built with a design in mind, and that means that the concrete slab can hold a certain amount of weight, that the piping that runs through the facility has certain paths and certain routes. And it's not just that. For reasons of resiliency, we don't like paths to cross, whether it's telecom paths or infrastructure paths. In other words, if I've got a water pipe in this case, I don't want it to be in proximity to its redundant water pipe in case there is a event in that area, and I don't want that event to take down both paths of power or connectivity or cooling or whatever. So when you imagine these technologies, especially around a legacy data center, and most data centers deployed today live in this world, we want them to get 75, 150 years out of them, let's just say. They're built to a certain spec. How would I introduce environments like this into there without breaking these fully operational Death Stars?
Yeah, that's a great question, because nobody wants to go in with a torch to an operating data center and start cutting into things. It's just that's everybody's fear. But I think it is doable. I think it is doable. It's certainly more doable if it's pre-planned, if some thought has been put into at some point we're going to go move our technology away from air and more towards water. We might put in some takeoffs there that we could use. But the way I see it, I think it can be done in steps. And the way to think about it is the white space probably is going to shrink itself for the same watt density.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so let's say that we're operating today and we're at 10 kW per rack. It may be more, it may be less. It's really hard, especially co-location facilities, it's really hard. But if I had a megawatt at 10 kW per rack, I would have 100 racks. Mm-hmm. But if I have 40 kW per rack of liquid-cooled servers, I have 25 racks. Mm. So my space has just shrunk, you know, unless I can bring more power in to populate that area. So I think that what we could see is wings of buildings that are slowly transferred from 100% air cooling to a hybrid model of both air and water. Mm-hmm. And I could also see the possibility of individualized racks that have very high workloads where we use liquid cooling to basically ensure we don't have a hot spot there, mm-hmm. right? It exceeded the capability of our legacy air cooling, mm-hmm. but we can still do it. We can generate revenue out of this rack, and we would do it. So I think it's doable. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's easy.
I have been skeptical for the longest time that this was going to be a requirement until really the last 2 years. In particular, especially if Don Mitchell's listening to this, who's been harassing me forever, a friend of ours from the industry.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Don. He's like one of those crazy street preachers, you know, and nobody wants to listen. And then all of a sudden it's here.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm not getting my due.
Yeah.
Why am I getting my due? So I know at the next event I see him at, he's going to really give me a hard time. But anyway, God bless him for keeping the faith and keeping the scriptures alive. But all the designs we're being asked for, not just from our largest customers, largest IT buyers on earth, but the intermediate and smaller shops are all also looking, how do I collapse an environment of this many to an environment of this many? Which is to say, they're not doing less work. They just want to collapse down.
Right, right.
Here's my reaction to this reality, though. What phone is it that you're using right there? How long have you owned that phone?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. 3 weeks. What was the first, I don't know if we call it smartphone, but real, other than a flip phone, something you could email with, something you could do a picture with. How long ago, what was your first one? Do you remember?
I think 2006, and it was definitely a BlackBerry.
BlackBerry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We got that BlackBerry. We thought this was it. This is everything.
Man, I could text so fast on that thing.
Yeah. I actually hated the BlackBerry. And before that, there was another one. I forget what it was. It wasn't the BlackBerry. It was a 3Com product, whatever it was. And I was network support at the University of Texas. But the director of my department required one of these, what we would now call, or the early version of what evolved into the smartphone. Mm-hmm. And I had to figure it out because I was the computer guy, right?
Yeah,
from
yeah.
print cues to this technology and make them work. And it was such a pain in the neck, but we all believed this is it. I mean, what more could you possibly need? Kind of like the experience when we first got our texts on a pager. Like, are you kidding me? Not just a number?
Right.
Inevitably call the office
yeah.
while I'm stuffing my crystals down my throat. I'm not calling the office. And today, you now have something that is more powerful than probably the shuttle's computer system in 1981.
Yeah.
So this is where I'm going, at least in my mind. The more we use, the more we want.
Yes.
And the more we want, the more we make. And the more we make, well, I may collapse that rack. Let's just say it's not 40 kW, it's 25 or 30 kW. I'm going to add more racks. Where I used to have a 32-inch television in my house that drew from the, you know, made the sun dim when it kicked on, I now have a 70-inch. Now, much less power, but I have 40 IoT devices. Like, I have all of these mm-hmm. things. And so the more I use, the more I interact with, the more I touch, the more I want. Not only the more I want, it can't be whatever that original perception and whatever. It can't be a 4K TV or a 1080p TV. It's got to be 8K. It's got to be got little quantum dots in it. It's got to have all of the latest and greatest. And in a couple years from now, in order to see the smears of the helmets in the Super Bowl, I'm needing the bigger. And that just for me means we're going to want more. And so whatever vacuum we created, on the one hand, I probably don't have to make the building bigger because I'll be able to do more within the building. Mm-hmm. But it just feels like whatever we imagine we're going to gain from space, we're just going to fill it up because we're deploying it in 100 different ways.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that anytime that we talk about clawing back power from the cooling system, realistically what we're talking about is clawing that power back and then giving it to the ITE, right? Because it's we're going to do more if we can.
Right.
And there's going to be some natural balance that's going to be based on what is the limit of power to that particular facility.
Right. So you think so with that in mind, this conversation so far, I'm imagining submersion. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's got more impact on the weight load of the floor. So not only do I have to handle the IT gear, I've got to handle this other thing. And that may be unfair to submersion people. We'll have some on here to talk about it. But that's what it feels like. The other thing is data centers used to be single story. I had off floor. And it used to be large roofs. I didn't have a low shell over it. I would have a 30-foot ceiling. And that's all completely changed. Designs today, whatever the inside looks like, especially if we're not using air and so it's all contained within these systems, we're going multi-story. We're not going out. Mm-hmm. The most valuable resource we have is the dirt. It's not the power. It's not the cooling. It's the dirt. I got a finite amount of that. Everything else, while it can be finite, it's not as finite as these are the four walls I got. So we're going up more and more. It's a change in data center design. I don't know how I stack immersion infrastructure, and I'm not trying to be naive. I just don't know what the impact of that, either for operation or for maintenance or for as things phase out and I need to phase in new things, as opposed to bringing something into an infrastructure I'm already used to working with. Granted, it's complicated, but I'm bringing it to a rack that already exists and I already know how to do that. Am I misunderstanding this? Is this an area that you think about?
Yeah, I mean, we see it a lot. I mean, I don't know what an acre of land goes for in Northern Virginia these days, mm-hmm. but it's enough that you want to build a three-story data center instead of a one-story data center.
Yeah.
And some technologies lend themselves a little bit better to multi-story buildings. There's some really efficient technologies out there that use pump liquid refrigerants that have problems with certain lifts of the refrigerant. Right. So what might work really well in a single-story data center is not necessarily going to work in a multi-story. Now, with liquid, the great thing about liquid is it's easy to move. Mm. I can as long as I have the pump power available, I can move that. We do it in skyscrapers all the time, right? So I can get that up there.
Okay.
So going back to the direct liquid chip versus immersion, in both cases, moving the cooling fluid is probably about the same amount of difficulty. The floor loading may be an issue for immersion. Maybe not. If the building's designed specifically to handle those weight loads, mm-hmm. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But in more traditional designs of multi-story data centers, I kind of think that the direct liquid to chip, once again, will sort of win out in the North American market because it's easier to apply to a multi-story data center.
Why wouldn't it win out in another market, do you think?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a really good answer for it. I just know, talking to my Chinese colleagues mm-hmm. out of Stoltz, China, mm-hmm. they feel very strongly that in China, the immersion cooling is being embraced ahead of the direct liquid to chip. Mm. I don't know what the market factors are that are driving that. It may just be a general acceptance here versus there.
Sure.
But we'll see. Only time will tell. And like we said earlier, you know, air is not going away. It's being supplemented by these new technologies. And a lot of it's being driven by the power of the chips too.
Yeah. Well, I just got to talk to somebody not long ago, Darwish Singh, who is a silicon intellectual property chip maker, really smart guy out of the Bay Area. And he made this great point that everybody in manufacturing is going to have some need for rendering, whether that's GPU, CPU, whatever, everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the emerging businesses are micro businesses. So if you were to compare this to movie making, for example, this is not Disney or Lucasfilm or somebody rendering, you know, thousands of GPUs to make a movie, it'd probably be in a much smaller scale. But they could deploy one of these environments in a rack and render, you know, you're logging online to, you know, make a new tennis shoe. And they give you the opportunity to, you know, they'll provide the base framework and you get to mess with the system on what the materials are, what the color is, you know, various design components or whatever. And they need to be able to render that out and do something with it. And there's just a million ways he talked about how this will impact manufacturing. And so I could see easily, even within legacy data centers, which are those that have that were not built to optimize a 40 or 50 kW rack. We imagined at most with containment, we're at a 15 to 18 kW air-cooled rack, right? And that just means bringing in infrastructure that shapes the air a certain way, that's really concentrated, that's at the time very sophisticated models on how we could get there, maybe not in an entire 500,000 square feet, but certainly in areas. And so there's a role still, even if it's not direct or liquid cooling like we're talking about, some assist or whatever. So I could maybe in some of these markets, their constraint isn't they don't have to go up, or these are all brand new facilities that they're building. And so, you know, the technology lends itself with their expertise and their supply chain and their engineering experience and whatever to do that. What's driving us going from 10 kW a rack to 40 kW a rack? I mean, that seems to be the big question.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of things behind that. So currently we're seeing chips coming out more powerful than we've ever had to cool before. And there's some interesting technology that is addressing that cooling part that's a hybrid of liquid and air.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about companies like Seguente or JetCool. What they've done is they've taken these powerful GPUs, which have a heat flux, and that's just the amount of heat per unit area that is too great for us to remove effectively with air, and they've put their device on it, which then takes it out to, if you can imagine, almost a radiator that then irradiates that heat out to the space where it can be handled by traditional air cooling. So it's answered one of the questions. I have a chip that's too powerful for me to cool with air by itself.
Right.
I'll add this device and now I can. So it extends the life of the legacy data center at these higher watt densities. But a lot of these higher watt densities are being driven, David, by things that are bearing down on us like AI. I mean, we have to, one of the serious drivers, because when we look at the NVIDIA chips that are coming out, they're just, they're hot.
Right.
They're really hot.
Right.
So
I agree. And they're big and they're bulky. One of the things that we're all working to make sure we're sophisticated with is supply chain. So, and for years, what we've been trying to do as a data center community is get our design simpler, more efficient, which lends itself to better inventory, training, reduces cost, like it just become more elegant. And now we're talking about introducing this new infrastructure, not just to, you know, retrofitting existing stuff, but even the new stuff. It adds a layer of complexity and whatever. But before we get into the operational side of it, I mean, do we have the supply chain to reconcile against all of the change?
It's getting better. The answer is probably not exactly right now, but it is getting better. I mean, from the depths of the pandemic and the struggles we had with the supply chain, you know, across the industry,
right?
You know, whether it was the servers, whether it was the gensets, the cooling systems, it's gotten better. We're catching up. I think we learned a lot of valuable lessons about dispersing our vendors and being able to utilize a lot of different components. I see the companies that are building liquid cooling coming on strong. I see them investing heavily. When I first started in this industry, there was only a handful of companies that were doing cooling in data centers. And now there's many, many companies out there doing that because they have seen that this industry is it's recession proof, it's pandemic proof, and it just continues to grow. And so smart people look at this and say, I want to be part of this.
Right.
And because for obvious reasons, there's a lot of security here and it's exciting. So you see a lot more people investing in not only the frontline components that go into the data center, but also the support components. We talked earlier about Belimo. They're not somebody you would have been talking to at a data center, or Don at Victaulic. As far as data center stuff, you wouldn't have been talking to them probably. But now, because their companies have understood the value of participating in this crazy industry, they're all on board. So the supply chain, from what I see from the factory, it is getting better, and I think there will be enough support for liquid cooling going forward.
Yeah, I recently talked to Melissa over at Belimo, and I love it when engineers who are by nature introverts and not particularly exuberant in their expression. And so if you judge those people by me, you're going to be sorely disappointed. But if you judge them by their fellow engineers, their eyeballs are popping out of their head. Yeah. So I say that with affection for Melissa and other engineers in all walks of life. But it did my heart good to hear her talking about smart devices and the way that the way that they're getting to efficiency and optimizing this critical infrastructure through this really cool intersection of engineering, precision engineering, really precise methodologies, thinking down the road in ways that they've never had to think before. And I think she's representing not just her org, but sort of this industry, but also partnering that with artificial intelligence tools, automation tools, really sophisticated machine learning that can mask itself as AI. And then also the component of how do I help other engineers that normally don't interact, like out on the floor, that don't lend themselves to wanting to mess, we know how to do our job. We've been doing this for 20 years. Well, now we need to adopt these tools. And this intersection of all of that, it's absolutely fascinating. Having said all of that, one of my my questions is to anybody that comes in here and talks about this, especially when we talk about supply chain. Many times we find out that while there's new people coming, they're going to the same shelf and box to get the components. They're not all manufacturing them independently, or they're getting them from different sources, or maybe they're getting them from two or three different sources, but they're all in the same city that come on the same boat or railhead or whatever it is. And so since you live more in that world than I do, we're the end consumer of that. We're not in the middle or at the source of that. The pandemic was painful across all industries for things that were not manufactured near us, where the supply, the trade route, was interrupted. Even if the source was able to get operational quickly to get it from there to its destination, and the whole world's now talking about liquid cooling and the need to get to this. And I guess the reason why I'm asking this question is I've sourced out a lot of the infrastructure within my facility. We've been doing that for a very long time. These are newer systems, by newer, I just mean in the last few years, pandemic forward. And everybody that's building a modern data center, which the scale has never been larger, the speed at which we've gone from building a data center or two every couple of years to 7 to 10 a year.
Speed of market is everything.
Absolutely. And they're exponentially more powerful. They're exponentially more efficient. They're exponentially more intricate. They're campuses of things. And so that's where I'm coming from with that question. Do you think that it's still a work in progress, but do you have high hopes that this is going to sort out and we're not going to have, we in our industry hate single points of failure. And are we resolving that?
Yeah, you know, I think that was the major pain point for us during the pandemic. We had originally brought the electronically commutated fan to the North American market back in 2004, and our partner in that was EBM Pabst, and fantastic fans and motors.
Pabst, the beer maker. Pabst?
No, it's a German. Sorry.
For a second, if you guys put that together,
well, you get a fan and a beer with every order.
You get three cool points.
Yeah. So anyhow, this is a fantastic piece of equipment, but we really found that we only use their fans.
Right.
So when they got into trouble, we got into trouble, and our lead times went out. So the one great takeaway that we took from the pandemic was now we have multiple vendors that produce very similar pieces of equipment, same types of efficiency. So it could be a Zilabig, or it could be a Delta fan, or it could be an EBM fan. We had some customers that said we want different technology. Some went back to AC induction motors with VFDs, variable frequency drives, because they could go down to the local shop and just buy one to replace it. And then some new technology came out as well. Infinitum Motors comes to mind. They use an air core stator, which is very different. So I think going forward, those of us that came through this painful period won't make that mistake again. So whether it's air cooling or liquid cooling, we'll be looking for multiple pump vendors, multiple valve vendors, heat exchanger vendors, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're all in that boat. The consumers of it, the suppliers of it, the manufacturers of it. I don't know to what extent, what do they call it? It's not repatriation, recontinentalization, or wherever, where you bring the source back to where it's within a continent or something like that. I don't know how long that will live, or if that's a momentary thing. We'll see. There are a lot of curious things going on in the world, but it's for sure a question that's on everybody's mind, especially when it's a it's funny, when I say emerging, people like our good friend Don and others, you know, they get a chill down their spine. It's not emerging. We've been doing liquid cooling in 100 ways, 100. Yeah. And I agree. We have had liquid cooling in our Richmond data center since we acquired it as a prefab chip plant.
Yeah,
and we had, we still have a liquid cooling environment in there, and we have them in other places with research organizations. But it wasn't like a normative, regular, Rittal, I remember, had one back in the early days, and others, I'm sure. But it wasn't like in every single design that we're looking at and planning in all of our customers. It was more a one-off or an oddity or an exception. And now it's the regular, it's almost the exception, certainly at the hyperscale level. It's the exception if you're not talking about it. They either need to see a path to it, or they need to see it applied right now. And so when we see these emerging things, we just, not emerging, but the emphasis on the new, that we don't end up in a spot, and I'm sure that, you know, it's not a question you're unfamiliar with dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, air cooling is not going away. And the reason for that is it's so flexible, it's so robust. You can move things around within the facility. It still works. You still have that going for you. Where I see the influx or the emerging technology is in very specific applications. I think AI is going to drive it. Right, without a doubt, just because of the high watt densities we're going to have to deal with. Some cryptocurrency folks have adopted it as well.
Really?
But yeah. Well, see, there's two. They go in two different directions. There's the group that says, I'm going to burn it to the ground.
Right.
I don't care. I'm just going to run this thing all out. And there's another group that's sort of said, well, wait a minute now. If I can get more compute per unit time, I can make more money, even though I paid more money for it. But at some point, I come out ahead.
Wow!
I don't know which one is right.
Yeah.
But you know, I'll sell equipment to both of them.
I don't know. It's so funny. I those guys, they're in their own world. I can't figure them out. I don't know.
I can't either. Yeah. David. I tried.
Yeah. Let's move on. We'll talk about something else.
Yeah.
I am. As I look at my notes here, I'm reminded. In the data center space, and I'm sure this is true of any critical infrastructure, whether it's a military vessel, it's a data center like what we make, whatever, we try to optimize our design. If I'm deploying the capital, if I'm deploying an environment, I don't care if it's a training environment for AI, I don't care if it's a IT cloud environment, whatever, I want to optimize it for a variety of reasons. We'll talk about some environmental and sustainability in a little while. But I want to get the maximum performance out of that environment.
Yes.
The enemy of optimization is agility. It just, you know, you want it fast, you want it cheap, or you want it accurate. Like, which I can give you for sure one, half of the other, none of the third. You, what's your combo, right? Fast and accurate, ain't going to be cheap. Accurate and cheap, ain't going to be fast. Like, what do you want? And so when we talk about something, when it's air, it's much more flexible to recover and redeploy environments today.
Yep.
If I'm deploying any of the technologies that we're talking about, in my naivete, it feels like the effort to be agile when an environment, maybe it's not training, becomes something else, but whatever it is, as I recover those environments and I need to redeploy them, I'm up against a barrier of infrastructure that I've deployed to accommodate the first environment.
Right.
How do we engineer so that I can get back to this sweet spot of I can optimize today, at least my imagined sweet spot, I can optimize today, and when it's time to recover the environment, I can do that. And I'm not changing the topology of the entire facility. I'm just doing it in that cage or that suite or that data hall, in a way that's not disruptive to the rest. Do we lose that for a while?
So, on a data hall level,
don't you like these easy questions?
Yeah.
You're making me
work here, David. If we take a look at a data hall, I think that's more realistic. The reason I say that is, in that data hall that's been designed for, let's say, chilled water CRA units.
So let's pause for 1 second. So we probably have people that don't know exactly what a data hall is. So let me just. So a cage would probably be about 3 racks, and then you've got literally a cage around it.
Right.
A suite could be any number, but usually that's a solid wall. It's got a door. In our world, that's probably a megawatt, 500 to a megawatt, up to maybe 10 or 20 megawatts, probably 4 or 5 megawatts, 6 megawatts. Mm-hmm. That would probably be, you could have an unusual situation. And those would all be surrounded. That'd be a single customer within that suite. A data hall, depending upon your data center, could be somewhere between 12, 15,000 feet up to 60,000 feet. It is not uncommon in big data centers like ours. So when you're talking about a data hall, it is a significant size. It may have one customer, which just takes up the whole hall. But if it's multiple customers, they're going to be in some combination of these cages and suites living within a data hall.
And typically, we could isolate them from the other data halls
That's
as well.
Correct.
So in that case, if we were starting out with a traditional chill water CRA, which is a computer room air handler system, what we would want to do is we want to utilize as much of what we have in place as we could. We want to keep as much of the piping as we could, which we should be able to keep a lot of. The raised floor, if it's there, we're going to use that as well. We'll use that to run piping underneath instead of what we would currently be running underneath. We'd probably get rid of the chiller outside, or maybe we'd keep it as a trim chiller because we don't really need it now. The temperatures are so high in the liquid cooling system that I can get by with now removing that equipment from the outside and adding dry coolers or fluid coolers, which are simply just heat exchangers that we blow air across, and pump packages to move the fluid through the data hall. That I can see being done, right? Because you'd be able to, you wouldn't have active customers within that data hall. You'd be able to go in, make your changes to your system, utilize as much of the existing system as possible, because there's embedded carbon in that system that we don't want to just toss out, right? As, you know, part of our decarbonization effort in our industry, and put something together and bring it back in. But then we'd have to have the customer, right, that was going to take that data hall and use it for liquid cooling.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, look, it feels it's not too far in the future that every deployment is going to have some component of liquid cooling. And that may be that, you know, not everything takes the same amount of cooling or whatever, but it's all going to sip from the trough. It's either going to draw heavily or it's going to sip from it. Like, they're just not going to be able to buy gear within a few years that doesn't either have hoses or is designed to be immersed or whatever, unless we've just misjudged what the marketplace looks like. And so I think for a while on our way to paradise, we'll have data halls that are air data halls. We'll have facilities that are air or air assist data halls. That'll be the normal thing. But as manufacturers move more, if they move more and more to at least the types of equipment that would go into a data center to, look, this infrastructure is intended to be cooled by a liquid cooling environment, not an air-cooled environment, I think it becomes less and less important. But it's, you know, I think we're early days, so I don't know that there's a strong answer. But we are constantly looking at, I need to optimize today, but I really need to have the agility to pivot.
Yes.
And when I say pivot, I mean like an aircraft carrier pivots. I don't mean like a ballerina pivots. It is a data center,
yes.
Right? Or or how I would pivot, not my 23-year-old daughter who could pivot much better than me. Which is to say with a lot of arm waving and horn blowing, you know, everybody
right.
watch out. But pivot nonetheless, right? I need to be able to redeploy that because I don't want to run for a significant period of time an unoptimized environment. That doesn't do us any good.
That's right. I mean, we have to, at the end of the day, the OpEx is critical.
Right.
And we have to balance our desire for these new technologies and these higher densities with what it actually costs to run and is it profitable. I mean,
right.
At the end of the day, this is a business. So,
and also, let's move into this area. What's sustainable? So I'm curious, what do you think the impact, like the real world impact to, you know, you mentioned earlier the carbon embedded. It is a regular conversation in pretty much every part of our world for a variety of reasons. People come to the discussion for a variety of reasons, but it's part of the discussion. So what's the impact of adopting whatever technologies adopted, liquid cooling in your mind, to carbon output, to you know, managing the power that we're talking about? What do you see the environmental impact as?
So I did an analysis a couple of years back. I compared like best-in-class air cooling, best-in-class liquid cooling. And what I found out was the first cost of the liquid cooling system were significantly higher.
Mm-hmm.
But the return on investment was under 2 years. And the reason for that was because of the OpEx, the amount of power that we were able to no longer use to provide the cooling, right? So now that's great, except – like you pointed out, we claw that power back. Now we're probably going to put it into another rack and move on.
Right.
When it comes to sustainability, and I'm a little bit of a bomb thrower here, but
you're in a safe place.
We're not sustainable, right? We're huge buildings that we dump a tremendous amount of power. We do great good. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, but as far as sustainability goes, we have a long way to go.
We could improve.
Yeah, we have a long way to go. There's great minds out there that
right.
are thinking about it, that are working on it. I think at the end of the day, if we can find ways to reharvest this heat energy that we currently just throw out the window, I think that is the path to actually beginning to be sustainable as an industry. In the meantime, everything that we do to save energy and operate in a more climate-friendly manner is good.
Mm-hmm.
But I fear that our industry is growing so fast that we're offsetting any gains by
right.
new facilities and new deployments.
Well, when we talk about so if we're just talking about, I don't know, and maybe this is I'm thinking about it incorrectly, but let's just say I've got a kilowatt of energy generated in a rack or in a system today, and it's air cooled. If I have that same kilowatt and it's liquid cooled, Am I more sustainable? Am I less sustainable? And maybe that's the wrong measurement or the wrong component.
No. I think that's a
okay.
Good,
so
a good
so
comparison.
Over a life cycle,
yeah.
of that infrastructure, and a lot of people think that it's like their home computer, like every 24 months. You know, this can't.
Yeah.
This can't fight the goblins as good as it could 2 years ago, so I need to upgrade my system. In IT infrastructure to handle, for most systems that are handling mail, that are handling back office stuff, that's archiving storage or whatever, they don't, it's so disruptive to their environment to swap it out every 18 to 24 months. It's just not, it doesn't happen like it did early days. It's going to get its full shelf life. Again, I know there are exceptions to that, but I'm talking about I'm not making movies, I'm not trying to learn the difference between a bee and a cat. I'm just talking about regular, everyday infrastructure that most of us use. That infrastructure lasts a while. At least in my experience, it lasts a while.
It does.
So if I run that to its full extent of its expected life, and it's air-cooled, and I've got 20 of those in a rack, or I've got, let's just say I've got 8 kW or 10 kW in that rack, and I got a rack next to it, and it's running at 40 kW, Those 1 kW increments, whether they're are they equal in their impact in their environment, or are they unequal over their lifetime?
Well, the lifetime question is really hard, and I'm going to have to think about that one for a while.
Well, rephrase the question however you want.
To go back to just making the comparison between the two, I can easily reduce the energy impact by 50% on the cooling side, just the cooling side. If we talk about the partial PUE or the mechanical PUE, I can take 50% of that power out simply by adopting this hybrid air direct liquid to chip solution. So that's hard to argue with.
Right.
Now, some of the other things are a little bit more difficult to quantify.
Right.
As we load up these racks, you know, what happens to, let's say I'm going to build a facility for this new design.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the brick and mortar facility could actually be smaller as well.
Sure.
Right? I mean, I don't need the physical. Now, I probably will because I'll decide I want to have a larger facility. But you have the chance to reduce. So your brick and mortar building can decrease in size.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's a carbon cost for
impact
that.
Impact to that, yeah.
Let's take a look at the electrical distribution system. If I'm able to shrink down the physical footprint of the white space, right? Less copper, less busway. I have, you know, savings there. I think it hasn't completely played out. I'm sure some really smart guy has sat down and figured out, you know, okay, I need this many less bricks and this much less copper. But I do believe it's going to be significant, the savings.
I hope so. I hope it is. I hope it is a positive impact in every way. Well, let's talk about one of my favorite areas. I won't say my favorite area, and I'm saying it tongue-in-cheek, regulation. When I get asked, is there anything that can disrupt, pick your industry, in a way that is not just disruptive, but difficult?
Yeah.
Regulation comes to mind. It's not always fair, but it comes to mind. I know you are an at least interested party and regularly participant in this area. What's going on in the world of regulation as it relates to data centers and cooling and across your desk?
A lot.
Yeah.
So we got hit with a double whammy here recently. The EPA came out and we're going to get rid of certain refrigerants because they have very high global warming potentials. So they took away our favorite refrigerant, which is R410A for our computer and air conditioners, and said, I'm sorry, that's 2088 GWP. You can have 700 GWP. Find another refrigerant. So as the end result, we'll basically have to trash every computer and air conditioner we have and redesign every product line for the new refrigerant. It's the right thing to do, and I embrace being good stewards of the environment.
Right.
The amount of work it makes for people like us is very difficult. At the same time, the Department of Energy has come out and said, oh, by the way, your equipment has to become more efficient now. Your computer room air conditioners have to become more efficient, and they give us a target specific to us in data centers, which is the net sensible coefficient of performance. Mm. It's basically how well do you cool a data center, because it has a very – we don't strip moisture and things like that, not to go into too much detail. So we got hit with these at the same time. The new energy efficiency requirements go into effect May 28th of this year, and the new refrigerants go into effect January 1st, 2027.
Now, is anything grandfathered into that?
No. 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 We will not be able to ship after May 28th of this year. We will not be able to ship a piece of equipment that does not meet the new
So a data center that's operating with infrastructure that does not meet the requirement, does it have to turn off that infrastructure?
No. It'll be fine. It will go on for years. We got rid of R22 back in 2010. Okay. You can still buy it today and service your equipment. But we are seeing some other things, too. There's a project in Maryland, Quantum Loophole, which is a large campus.
Yeah, Josh Snowhorn and those guys. Yeah, really smart guys.
Yeah. You know, they really struggled because Maryland came in and said, hey, wait, you can't have all these motor generators because think of all that pollution.
Right.
Not really understanding what those units were for, how often they ran.
And if they ran all those things enough to cause a problem, they'd be out of business.
Exactly. And it was just a lack of understanding on the state's part of what these pieces of equipment did. Now, the good news is it looks like we're getting out of that. We're coming to an agreement where they're understanding the use of it. But that kind of regulation is very detrimental to a site like that because it's perfect. It's all set up. The power, the high voltage lines go right to that site because it was a aluminum smelter at one point. Mm-hmm. And you get a customer in, and then you say, "Well, no, I'm sorry, you can't have your motor generators." Well, you need them.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's the communication needed to make sure we're all on the same page. Sometimes it's amazing it goes right, and other times I'm amazed at how such smart, well-intentioned, hard-working Americans that want to do right, be good stewards for whatever, and that we just miss somehow. For whatever reason, I'm not going to assign motives, but we just miss. Fortunately, it sounds like in this case, and in a lot of times, not in every time, we get an opportunity to come and sit down and work to not only be understood, but to understand, which really lends itself, I suppose, to the conversation that we're all having today about community. You know, I'm a firm believer that human beings flourish the most when we're in community. In your world, does this come up much, this conversation about communities and the need for us in critical infrastructure to have more and more of these conversations before we're breaking ground?
More so recently than in the past, definitely, because we have seen a pushback in places like Loudoun County, Virginia, Chandler, Arizona is another place where we as an industry have not done a good job explaining what it is we do, how we do it, and really take into account the concerns of that community. If we did, we'd probably build our buildings to be a little bit more attractive, maybe a little bit more green space to sort of wall them off. We'd be very concerned about the noise, primarily of the cooling systems the things that really bother some folks that live in the vicinities of large data centers. I think we just missed it in the past. Now we're not. Mm-hmm. Now we've realized, we've woken up to the fact that there's people out there that don't want a data center in their backyard. And the reason they don't want a data center in their backyard may not be right? Mm-hmm. It may be a misconception on their part because they're all very much want to continue to use their phones and their computers and you know, telehealth, telemedicine. Mm-hmm. But we need to reach the leaders of the communities and the folks out there in the places we want to plant our data centers and start the conversation before we break ground. Tell them who we are, what we're doing, what good we do, and what we're going to do to protect their concerns.
It's really part of the communication, and I hope people embrace getting engaged in this, because that's the best version of us, I think, is when we get engaged and we build something like that.
Yeah, we have to. We can't go forward in the way we did in Northern Virginia. We have to bring the community in. We have to let, because they don't know. A data center is just a big building to them.
Right.
And they've never been inside one. They've never been allowed to be inside one.
Right.
And they don't know. And so what we need to do is we need to really have outreach to the community with an educational aspect that, like, this is what we do. This is the value that we bring. We don't just take power and water and tax breaks from you folks.
Right.
We bring all these other things to the table that benefit us as a community and as a society.
Right.
And maybe we haven't been as good at doing that as we should be.
Yeah. We have always believed in community involvement. And in many communities, it's well known, we're participants. Mm-hmm. In some ways, Northern Virginia is an outlier. There were 70% of the world's data goes through Northern Virginia. And so there was such a tremendous growth that nobody saw coming, not the power infrastructure people, not the communities around us, not us ourselves, nobody. And when all of a sudden there's a lot of activity going around, I think it's natural for people to say, what's going on? What's happening? And then let's get to the facts of that and make sure we fit the narrative and we're all working together. And then as we go, let's learn from that. As we go into the wherever it is that we're growing into, which is to say, I mean, when we talk about data centers, we're talking about MRI images. We're talking about sermons that are stored digital. We're talking about the formula for Coca-Cola. We're talking about the semi-pro SEC football league that we're watching on TV. We're talking about our lives. Like, the ideas of the whole world live in this infrastructure. And so when we're bringing this infrastructure, this natural growth closer to people, the idea is it's for human flourishing. That's the big idea. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to, we want that to happen. We want it to benefit human beings. We just need to make sure we're having a conversation, I feel like, so that we're actually serving our purpose. And when we do that, it works.
Mm-hmm.
So where's this whole thing going? Where's this liquid cool thing going?
So it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen next year. But at some point, there will be an inflection point where we shift away from air cooling to liquid cooling. I say that only because the physics and the economics dictate it at some point. God, I love air cooling. Been doing it for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm embracing the liquid cooling side as well.
Mm.
And I'm a strong proponent of it. And I think that as we see these watt densities increasing in the racks, because we're not going to use less data, we're not going to use less compute, we're going to use more.
I need more cat videos, for sure.
I love cat videos.
Yeah, me too. Secrets.
It will happen. That's my take on it. It's going to be a while in the coming. I mean, we've been talking about this for 10 years now, but it's maturing fast. And there are ASHRAE, which is the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers.
Wow.
Sounds like a really exciting group, doesn't it?
Let's make that an acronym,
yeah,
please.
They are tackling liquid cooling now in a powerful way. They're bringing in the best and the brightest from the server manufacturers, the cooling manufacturers, everybody, bringing them together and developing standards that will allow consumers to compare liquid cooling systems apples to apples, right? And I think that's really important, because right now, with no real standards out there, no test standards, it's really difficult to decide what's best. What's going to work best? You have to just basically take the word of whoever the manufacturer is. So I think ASHRAE has taken a very powerful step to giving us the tools to more readily accept the technology.
Do you think it's just going to be these two primary technologies we've talked about? Are we just going to be refining those? Or is there something out there that's being talked about that we haven't figured out yet, but could be a new player?
Well, there could always be disruptive technology coming along. I wish my crystal ball worked better, David.
It's now called ChatGPT. Yes. We don't call it crystal ball anymore.
It kind of stinks. I see these as the two that are going to mature. And then maybe something will come out of them, the one or the other that diverges somewhat. Uh-huh. For the time being, for the next decade or so, I think it's going to be one of these two technologies.
All right. Well, haven't we talked about? We've been talking for an hour and 15 minutes or so now. What haven't
really?
We talked about that we should have mentioned before we wrap it up today? Anything? We covered a lot.
Yeah, we did. We covered a lot. We didn't talk about small modular nuclear reactors. That's always cool.
That's always fun.
That's always fun. But we'll
say that for another conversation.
We'll do that for another conversation.
Yeah.
No, I think I really like the fact that we touched on the importance of community outreach and educating people as to what we do in this industry.
Look, we build these infrastructure in my mind to help each other, help ourselves, of course, but help each other. If we're not doing that, what's the point? And I've been doing this for a long time. I'm not naive. But that's the point. It's the, I want the 911 system to work. I want the
Absolutely.
All of these things that are online, which is to say everything is online. And the closer it is to the job that it needs to do without breaking my community, it can't break the environment. It can't break job opportunities. It can't sacrifice the group of human beings that are in the area, whatever the resources they need, just for this. None of that works. It has to be this interplay. And there's one of my favorite conversations with our buddy Dean Nelson over at iMasons and Cato and whatever, is wherever some of these conversations go, his heart and a lot of people that align in that, sometimes very robust conversation, That's a regular part of it, and so I'm really optimistic that as we reach out, it's not to manipulate, it's to partner, and I hope that's more and more what we do. I think that people will see through it if it isn't, and they'll just discard
them.
Well, Dave, thanks for coming on today. I had a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I mean, this is great.
My great pleasure. Hey, look, everybody, if you enjoyed that conversation, like it. And if you loved it, subscribe. We'll see you next time. Have a good one.